Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm John Snyder, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
I'm Tom Gentry. If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. This is The Path to Authenticity. This is a special episode to me. I don't know why I didn't think of doing this sooner, to be honest, but you know, over the last couple years, I've been working on some writing projects, and there were so many times I've just wished I had somebody like this guest to read my work and to give me constructive feedback. And I thought of him. I had him in the back of my mind so many times, and I don't know why I didn't think to reach out to him until a couple weeks ago. When I did, and it's been an awful long time since we spoke last, but John Snyder was my high school journalism teacher, better known as Snyder. That's what everyone just seemed to naturally call him, and it always felt fitting. So we reconnected. I gave him a call, got him on the phone, and as we're talking, I'm thinking, man, I got to get him on the podcast. And I'm so glad I did. So I have a son who's 14 years old. He's about to start as a freshman in high school. And it's such a weird time right now with COVID-19 when the school district where I live announced a couple weeks ago that the school year will begin remotely indefinitely. I was so relieved because there's so much pressure coming from Washington to open the schools. And being in South Florida, I mean, it's a mess down here right now. It's as bad as it is anywhere. And doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me to open schools when the atmosphere is like three times as bad as it was when they closed them back in March. So when I heard that press release that they were doing that, I was very relieved and didn't realize how anxious I was about it until that moment. But, you know, my son's going to find his John Snyder, and this whole idea of sending kids back to school, you know, it's endangers kids, it endangers teachers, and teachers are special people. And if you want to see a good movie that expresses this pretty clearly and effectively, Mr. Holland's Opus. That's a movie that I saw at a really critical time in my life, and it just kind of opened my eyes that I want to affect people's lives. I want to help people. And I so much love hearing Snyder talk about why he became a teacher. He's a really modest guy, but he talks about why he taught and I am a living example of why he taught. He was a guy who was there for me. He was a good man who was there for me at a time of my life when I probably needed it most. He had no idea what I had going on at home at the time, but I was being verbally and emotionally abused by an older brother pretty constantly. And, you know, it's taken me years to kind of unravel and work on how much that has affected me and to really own that that's what happened. But, you know, he was there for me back then. He was, you know, the cheerleader for me and the person I could count on when, you know, there's a lot of, stuff that happened while I was in high school, with other students, a lot of sad stuff. And he was always looking out for me and there for me. And I went to him for, you know, guidance at times and for assistance. And on top of all that, he taught me how to write. And we talk about that a little bit. And one of the things I wanted to talk to him about is the current state of journalism in this country, because it's really a mess. So we get into that a little bit toward the end. You know, to be honest, I can't emphasize enough how important this guy has been to me in my life. And when I think about the people who were really there for me and cheering me on, and there are a handful of them, and he's at the top of the list. He really is. And after talking to him and thinking about what I was going to do with this episode, I realized, you know, he had this presence, and we talk about that in the episode a little bit, and it was strong and firm, but also supportive and loving. And, being a substance abuse counselor and working with a lot of young guys, I realized that same spirit he had with us kids back then, you know, I kind of in some ways and channeling it, which I just think is a really cool thing. So one of the things that I've really come to learn as I've aged is, you know, the people from my past who are there and positive. I mean, my love for them just grows exponentially as the years go by. And that's definitely the case with Snyder. So I hope you enjoy this. I sure did. And, happy to have this guy back in my life, and I plan on keeping him around. So here you go. John Snyder. Snyder, it is, I can't even tell you how happy I am to be doing this with you today. How are you?
I'm great. I'm honored to get a chance to do something with you. This is out of my realm of experience, so I'm excited.
Yeah. Well, you deserve a pat on the back then, because most of the people I encounter who this is out of their realm of experience, they don't even want to try it. They just say, no way, I'm not going to do that. So I appreciate the enthusiasm.
Well, at my age, I figure if I don't do it now, there might not be a second chance. So who knows?
Well, I don't know about that. I'm not going to ask you your age, but, you know, I've been looking forward to this a lot, and one of the reasons is because, you know, you, for those who are listening, Snyder was my high school journalism teacher, and what's really nice is that, you know, our relationship has always been about me, because I was the student and you were the teacher. And we've had an opportunity to talk a few times over the course of the years, but I've never really gotten to know much about you. So I relish that opportunity. And so let's hear it, man. Where'd you grow up?
Well, I grew up in LaPorte, Indiana, which is up north. We were more Chicagoites than, you know, Indianapolis. I very seldom, if ever, came to Indianapolis. We were South Bend and Chicago. Mm-hmm. That's where we went to do things and such. And between Notre Dame and the Cubs and the Bears, that's where my allegiance still lies.
Yeah.
And it was a nice community, a little smaller than Kokomo, population wise for the county, but the town at that time was very similar. Mm-hmm. Alice Chalmers, Modine's, Whirlpool, kept a lot of people employed. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, I had about the same number in the senior classes as what you had at Hayworth. Mm-hmm. And such. And so, you know, we have similar experiences, I'm sure, as far as those kinds of things. But of course, a lot of age difference. I was a swimmer mainly. I played some football till I messed up my knee and tried to run track and such, but wasn't very good. And eventually that faded away. I later found out that I have a heart valve issue that prevents, you know, from getting full oxygen. So that's my excuse now. If I could go back and dig my track coach up
and tell him,
and tell him I was trying as hard as I could.
Yeah.
I was giving it my all. When I found out I had this problem, my doctor said, you know, you watch basketball on TV and see these guys going down the court and all of a sudden they fall over dead. So, yeah, I've seen that a few times. He says, well, that's what you got. And I thought, man, you know, between the swimming, the running, the football, I guess I got lucky that it didn't happen to me when I was doing one of those things. So,
well, I was going to ask you about basketball. You're tall. So
I made it. LaPorte's basketball teams were bad. Okay. We played against Michigan City. They were our rival. And from 1945 till about 1985, LaPorte lost sectionals. Michigan City or one of the county schools would win every time. So I made a decision in seventh grade that I was going to focus on football and swimming and forget basketball.
Oh, that's too bad.
And I the swimming did, you know, I was good. And it got me jobs as a lifeguard. In college, I got jobs as a lifeguard. In fact, I swam at Ball State 1 year, but realized that the 200 butterfly was twice as long as I could handle. And again, now I find out that it was my heart.
Yeah.
You know, couldn't handle the distance because I was good for short distances. I was as good as most people, but when it got to the longer distances, I just couldn't hack it. And of course, then I was, you know, done. So, parents were working class. Dad was a painter. Mom worked a variety of jobs. I had two brothers. I'm in the middle. And, you know, pretty standard,
Midwest,
you know, upbringing at that time. Yeah. Yeah. Dad was, had some issues, but, you know, had three boys to keep in line. Mm-hmm. So that was never easy. We used to fight a lot and all those kinds of things as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. But I spent a lot of time at the YMCA for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably where I got the bug to be a teacher. Used to have learn to swim classes in spring break. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, probably about the time I was about 12 or 13, I would do that at spring break. And the guy that ran them never really paid us anything for doing it, but we'd go across the street and have a big sup, our big dinner on the last day. And that was our pay. And we'd accept, you know, accept that there were about four or five of us that would help with that. And, you know, the idea of helping somebody, seeing somebody accomplish something they didn't think they could accomplish. I think that's what pointed me in that direction. And then as I got older, you know, everybody thought I was going to be a coach. And, so I went to Ball State because that was the, supposedly the best teaching school. And I wanted to be the best teacher I could. And so if that was the place, you know, then I was going there. And, at the time I swam, like I said, 1 year, but at IU, Mark Spitz and people like that were swimming for Doc Councilman at IU. So there wasn't any chance that they'd even let me pick up the towels. So, swam at Ball State. And after I got on campus, you know, I was uncertain about what I wanted to do besides teaching. And so I took some social studies, took a phys ed classes, took beginning journalism class. And when I got done with it all, I thought about, you know, where is the future going to go? My dad wasn't crazy about me being a teacher anyway. And he said that that was a waste of an education. So that was, you know, something I wanted to prove him wrong. And so anyway, I decided that, you know, I was going to go to journalism route and history because then I could do some things. And if they needed a swim coach, I'm sure they could make arrangements for it and such. And, I liked the whole aspect of the media and the photography, the writing, the design, you know, all of it I liked. And, so I took every journalism class I could take, every education class I could take, because I wanted, you know, to be as good a teacher as I could be. But like most people will find out is that going to college is something that you want to experience. But when you get out in the real world, I learned more in the first, you know, year of teaching than I did 4 years at Ball State. You know, the real world was a whole lot different than what they did. There was things I picked up at journalism classes and such, but as far as the education classes went and such, I was not prepared to be a classroom teacher when I started, but I had a rough start. I don't know if you remember telling the story that my first job I took over because a woman had a nervous breakdown.
I don't remember this. Now, where was this?
This was at Indianapolis Arlington.
Okay.
And it was at a time, 1974, and I went to a high school where we had 10 African-American students in the high school. And I did my student teaching at Michigan City Elston, which had about 15 to 20% African-American students in. So I thought I had a little taste, you know, a little idea. And I went to Arlington, and they were in transition from being IPS's Carmel school to being desegregated. And now they were on their way to 50%, you know, 50-50 to more minorities than white. And it was a rough transition for the teachers and such. And, of course, the classroom was different than anything I'd ever experienced, and the kids, even the kids that worked for me on the yearbook and newspaper, were more aggressive than any kids that I had ever come across. You know, it's just the big city is what I believe. And so I then, you know, quickly learned, you know, that I was going to have to wake up and get, you know, with the program. I can honestly tell you that if I hadn't been married, I'm not sure I would have lasted the first year at Arlington. But because I was already married, I had obligations, and I was convinced, and I couldn't quit. You know, I just, you know, I couldn't quit. Yeah. And I figured if I quit this job, then I would be a failure and I'd probably never get to teach again. And I couldn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent 3 years at Arlington. And the lady that had been at Arlington had been National Journalism Teacher of the Year.
Wow.
And she was not teaching at IU. And her name is Mary Benedict. She had no kids, no husband, no life other than journalism. And she was a fireball. Well, the principal at Hayworth called and said, you know, I need a journalism person. Who do you recommend? And she recommended me because of the fact that I had hung in at Arlington and had turned things around to the point where it was something halfway decent or maybe even kind of good compared to what had happened after she had left. And it just, the wheels had fallen off.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we had a program going again and a product that was pretty good, kids involved. And she recommended me to the principal at Hayworth. And that was all it took. Mm-hmm. When I got there for the interview, the job was mine. And that was that.
Mm-hmm.
So so I had the job at Hayworth. Mr. McCool, you know, played around with my one-year-old son during the interview more than he did any talking to me. And then, you know, I was at Hayworth and I was thrilled to death because Hayworth program was one of the top ones in the state. And I knew I was, I had just walked into my dream job. And I'll tell you, Tom, I never felt much different. Kokomo and Hayworth, I knew that I landed in a place for me, and I was thrilled to death the whole time. Mm-hmm. I didn't thank God enough for, you know, putting me in that place, because it was, you know, great 30 years, whatever it was. You know, I couldn't have picked a better place.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so, you know, Hayworth, Kokomo. I mean, if you listen to this show, you know, I'm from a town called Kokomo, Indiana, and there were two high schools there for a long time, Kokomo and Hayworth. And by the time I was in middle school, you know, the population in the town had dwindled. Some factories had closed. They merged the high schools. And so I went, at the time that I went there, it was a two campus high school, where we had 8th and 9th grade on one campus and 10, 11, 12 at the other. And so I met Snyder. You were my first period teacher my sophomore year in high school. I don't know how well you remember that. What's that?
I said that had to be a rude awakening to have me first period.
Well, you know, I had to stay on my toes. You know, yeah. I learned that pretty quickly. And, you know, it was an interesting place. And, you know, I was riding to school with, a couple seniors, from my neighborhood who, you know, were engaging in some behaviors on the way there that I learned pretty quickly that I couldn't be doing that if I was going to be in your first period class. So, you know, I was like you mentioned in college, just signing up for every journalism and teaching class you could find. I did the same with any media class I could find from middle school on. And so, you know, I see this journalism elective and I took it and, you know, I mean, I think of it as where I really learned to write. You know, I think to some degree, you know, I've never been a person who agonized over writing. It just kind of happened. But, you know, I learned how to do it from you in that class.
Yeah.
And I've thought about that a little bit over the last couple of weeks. And, you know, this is a sophomore in high school journalism news writing class is really what it was. I mean, you know, and we wrote stories that were due then, you know, And, and it served me so well, you know, fast forward about 8 years, I was interviewing for, an internal marketing position at this facility where I worked. And, it was like the longest, most agonizing interview process that I'd ever been through. It was like 3 or 4 interviews. And wow. The last one, you know, it's me and her in this little tiny office. And she said, write a press release, you know, announcing that you got this job. Like, so right now in front of me. And I, you know, I did it.
Yeah.
I did it. And that got me the job over, you know, people who on paper were probably more qualified. So, you know, it was a huge value to me to have that. And, and, you know, and you know, you mentioned the program there. I mean, for me, you know, to end up on that newspaper staff, it's like I struck gold because it wasn't just a high school newspaper, right? No. I mean, it was a great high school newspaper.
Yeah. Well, we won a lot of awards, so somebody thought it was pretty good other than just us. I don't remember if, you know, things that far back and all, but you probably went to some of those journalism workshops where we had contests and things like that. And sometimes it got embarrassing for how many times they would have a Kokomo kid come up and win things.
Yeah.
And do you remember Anthony Coleman was an artist?
I don't.
Again,
I don't think
different
so.
Years. They all blend together, mm-hmm. but we had he was an editorial cartoonist.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy that was the judge was the head editorial cartoonist for the Indianapolis Star.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, this kid is better than I am. And by rights should have my job.
Yeah.
And then he said, Anthony Coleman from Kokomo High School.
Yeah.
And you know, you wanted to fall out of your chair to hear this guy's, you know, professional that had won all these awards for the Star say something like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, those were the kind of kids. You know, I call them,
mm-hmm.
and students that we had, the staff members, and you know, I always looked at my job was stay out of the way, do what you have to help them, but don't get in their way too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it worked pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, you had a really special kind of presence. You did. I mean, and it makes sense, you know, you described it basically, but you know, it was also, I mean, it was strong and, we knew to take you seriously, but it was also, you know, supportive.
Right.
And you were always approachable,
right.
You know, wow. Which I don't know that I could say that for too many of my high school teachers, you know. I mean, you were definitely approachable.
Right. Well, I think, you know, we used to have the relationship where, you know, I wanted something from you.
Mm-hmm.
And so in return, I figured I had to give you something. And sometimes it was cutting you some slack, right in the past, looking the other way. But you know, when time came to do things, we got things done.
Yeah.
And I always remember one lady walking by that was the librarian. And she was, you know, in our hallway. We had no, you know, not many other classrooms in that hallway. And she said, I don't know how you accomplish what you accomplish by walking by and seeing what those kids are doing, but you sure get them to do it some way. And I just laughed and said, you know, she was from old school and, you know, we weren't doing it the way she thought was to do it, but we were doing something pretty good, I thought.
Well, and I imagine over the years you got an eye for who to recruit onto those staffs, right?
Yes, I did. And I got to tell you, one of the things that I didn't realize in college, and they didn't teach you this in any education class, but a few positive words can change a person's life beyond what you ever could understand.
Yeah.
Because I would have, you know, we had used to have a lot of sophomores and juniors take journalism classes, English option. And I can't tell you how many times I would say something to somebody and say, you know, you really know how to write, you know, or you're really pretty good at this writing thing. Mm-hmm. And bam, the next thing they were on staff, bam, the next thing you were going to college to be a journalism teacher or a journalist, you know, and here a girl that was sitting, I always remember this girl sitting in the back of journalism class that wouldn't hardly look up, look you in the eye, ended up going to become a professional journalist. Mm-hmm. And where that came from, I honestly think it was because I complimented her one day and that she hadn't received a whole lot of compliments. And that was that. And I'm sure that there were some other factors involved. I can't take all the credit. I don't mean to take all the credit.
No.
But I do recognize the fact that a few positive remarks can go a long way, because there's a lot of high school kids that aren't getting many of them from other places where they should be, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that, well, you know, I definitely had that kind of experience with you, and it meant a lot to me, you know? I mean, my mom, you know, I remember going to parent-teacher night with her and introducing her to you. And I didn't, you know, I wasn't around listening to you guys talk, but, you know, I guess it was a parent-teacher conference. But
right.
By the time we get in the car to go home, you know, I mean, she was just kind of, she said, you know what he said about you? He said, you have class. And, you know, can you imagine your mom ever hearing anything better from a teacher than that? And, you know, and that was something you said to her, not to me, you know?
Right.
And, you know, I've talked about it on this podcast before, like just, you know, the day you grabbed me by the arm and pulled me into your classroom and told me I was going to be a sports writer. I mean, that, you know, I'm 47 years old. I'm still talking about that, how it was important to me.
Yeah.
And in my, you know, in counseling, addictions counseling, I mean, you know, we do assessments and, you know, it's like a lot of healthcare. It's really kind of tuned into finding what's wrong with somebody, what's going wrong.
Okay.
What they're doing wrong. And it was a real like milestone in my career when, I was, collaborating on a case with this therapist and I was running the program where this kid was living, and I would call this therapist and say, oh, he didn't do this or he didn't do that. And, you know, and he would say, oh, but you know, he's really great at this. I mean, he would always come back at me with a strength that this kid had. And it really opened my eyes that I had trained myself, not even necessarily in work, but in life, to find what's wrong with somebody.
Yeah.
And I realized, like, that's not who I want to be. You know, I want to be a guy who sees the good in people. And, you know, he became one of my mentors, and I talked to him about it, and I learned to do that, you know, and sometimes just, you know, just kindness.
Right.
It goes a long way.
And a lot of people would look at me and not see kindness as one of my attributes, but, you know, tried to be. I always remember one of the girls, the last years I did in yearbook, said, you know, you are kind of intimidating. And I thought, and she just came out and said it. And I thought, there's times when you have cafeteria duty when you want to be intimidating, but I never saw myself in the classroom as being that figure. So I guess, just have to mix some of it in the right time.
Yeah. And it's different. Women perceive us differently than we perceive ourselves, and everyone perceives us differently than we perceive ourselves. But, you're a big, tall guy.
Yeah.
And you just kind of walked around with this, business kind of, you were very focused.
When I did my student teaching, the first day I taught history class, I taught from behind the desk. And my high school teachers, a lot of them had taught from behind the desk or stood at the podium. And when the lesson was done and we were, the kids had left, and I looked at him and said, you knew your material. Things that I thought went well. You had good control, but I'm going to tell you one thing you did wrong that I never want to see again. I said, well, what was that? He said, you sat at the desk. He said, don't you ever sit behind the desk again. And I never did. That was the only one and only lesson that I ever sat at the desk and taught. From that point on, I was on my feet and moving. And he was right, to keep the attention, to keep things moving, to keep, discipline and make kids aware, you're walking up and down the aisles or whatever in computer lab. I used to walk up and down behind them to see what they were doing, just so they knew I was there and that, if they needed help, there I was to help them. Mm-hmm. But I'll never, that one thing, one lesson, again, something you didn't get in college, but you sure did once you got in the real world.
Well, and, it's funny. The other thing about it, from a psychological perspective, the desk is a barrier.
Right.
And that's in my work, like doing groups and counseling, I never want to have anything between me and a client besides space,
Right.
And, COVID-19 has, posed a little bit of a challenge with that. I'm doing an awful lot of stuff over Zoom, but it's not as difficult as I thought it would be. It's really not been that bad, but. So you taught for over 30 years.
Yes.
And now, so just college, you got the bug for journalism, or did you have it before?
Believe it or not, in high school, I was a sports editor. And, cause I was all about sports we had a little rinky dink newspaper that we typed on a typewriter you're going to love this. This won't make any sense to you at all. But when you typed your story, when you got to the end of a line, the margins were set up on these typewriters. So when you got to the end, you were getting close to the end of the line, you had to stop and hit a slant key. How many times it took you to get to the end of that width. Mm-hmm. Then you'd hit the return and go back and type the next line. Then when you were done with the story, in order to justify the columns, you'd have to retype the story, and how many spaces you had at the end is how many spaces you had to put between the words.
Oh my God.
So you actually, So you actually had to type your story twice.
Wow.
And then if you were cutting the story out to paste it down onto the page, if you weren't paying attention and you cut the story somehow so that you trimmed the letters off, then you had to go back and type it again.
Oh, man.
Now, this was 1968 and 69. That's where I started. And, of course, when I'm done, we're using PageMaker, Photoshop. Mm-hmm. We're doing things, that I never could have dreamed of back even when I was in college. But that's how we had to justify columns.
Mm-hmm.
So, but again, I read, I read the newspaper from the time I was a kid, young man, I should say, read, I was always a reader. I like to read you know, biographies about athletes and such. And so, and again, you know, living by Chicago, I was able to read the Chicago Tribune, the Sun Times, you know, those newspapers with the sports and, of course, columnists like Ryko and things like that, that, you know, that pointed me in all in that direction. Because you had these terrific models to read. And Sports Illustrated, at one time I had a closet full of Sports Illustrated because I would use my own money for mowing lawns and such to renew the subscription, but I'd never throw them away.
Yeah.
And finally, when I went to college, I came home from college and my mother said, "All right, this is enough. You've got to get rid of these sports." And, you know, I basically wanted to, you know, cry because, you know, some of them I'd had for 10 years, I think, and such. But, you know, my fallback position had always been, if you can't do the teaching thing, if the teaching's too much or you're no good at it or whatever, then you're going to go work as a sports writer. So that was my fallback position. Now, after I went to college and learned how to take pictures, then I would, you know, probably lean more to a photographer because I really, really liked that.
But, so was there ever a time in your teaching career when you wished you were a sports writer instead of a teacher?
Well, it was rough in Arlington, I'll tell you that. Yeah. And you know, I came in and if you can believe it, in October, and we had a spring delivery yearbook. And so that means that we had to have the yearbook done by end of February. And when I started, there was nothing. The lady had accomplished nothing. And I always remember this yearbook rep telling the principal, he says, "I just want you to know that it, you know, your advisors pulled a miracle off, because there was no way we figured they were going to get the yearbook done."
Wow.
And we got it done, and it wasn't awful. It wasn't great, but it wasn't awful. And then from then on, it got better. But there were times, but there was, it's funny you would ask the question, because I was anticipating some of the things you would ask about looking back and such. And it was, there was a time where I wondered whether or not, you know, that I should continue teaching while I was at Hayward. And it wasn't anything, one thing. It was just, you know, you're looking at the money, you're looking at your, I got two kids now, you know, is this, that, and the other thing. And I basically decided, all right, you know, the next couple months, whatever, you know, you're going to have to make a decision one way or another and start talking to your wife about this. Because I hadn't shared with her that I was thinking this. And I'll tell you what, Tom, over the next 2 or 3 days, I had feedback from kids about one thing or another and something, you know, come up here or there. And it erased all doubt. And, you know, it was, and from that point on, I never second-guessed myself. I was fully committed to do whatever I could. And I just, you know, but that time was, I was finishing my master's. And at that point in time, you know, you think, well, this is a heck of a time to make a career change, but if you're going to do it, you got to do it now.
Right.
And some, you know, these things happen. I got the positive feedback or whatever it was. I don't even remember now.
Right.
But I just remember thinking, no, this is what you're supposed to do. Quit worrying about it and just do it. Mm-hmm. And that was it. It was never second guessing it again.
Well, I'm sure glad you didn't. So, you know, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about journalism too.
Right.
You know, one of the things that drives me crazy right now is this whole fake news expression. Yes. That we hear over and over and over again.
Yes.
I care, you know, I grew up in a home where we talked about politics, and I mean, I've taken a class on the Constitution. Like I care and I love history.
Right.
And, So once in a while, like I'll get, you know, really fired up and I'll post something about, you know, usually it's sharing a story. And, you know, for me, sharing a news story, it's generally like the New York Times or the Washington Post, like a really good newspaper. And almost invariably someone will tell me, you know, the media this and the media that, and, you know, it drives me crazy because it's been repeated so much now.
Right.
That there's a segment of the population that just believes it's true.
Yes.
And it has become weaponized.
Yes, it has. And it's scary to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's truly scary because, you know, schools don't teach journalism class like they used to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the class that you had, by the time, you know, Mrs. Bingaman and I used to have 6 or 7 sections a semester, you know.
Right.
And in a school year, we would have, you know, almost every sophomore and a good chunk of juniors that would have taken that class and sprinkling a few seniors that finally decided they wanted to take it or something. So we had a fair part of the population. Today, she's lucky if she has 10 students in her journalism class, and it's one class.
Right.
And what happened, of course, when I was even teaching, the numbers dwindled and dwindled because they weren't part of the I-STEP test. And they couldn't comprehend that the writing part of the I-STEP test, no matter what research I tried to show them, and books, you know, or take to the counselor's office and such, and show them the research that, you know, taking a journalism class, kids actually scored higher on the SAT because they learned how to write clearer. They were able to organize their thoughts. They understood, you know, what paragraphing was, all these things that are important. But, you know, they couldn't wrap their head around the concept that you know, this was going to really help them on the I-STEP test. So we got lost in the shuffle. And no matter how much I threw a fit and tried to change the path, it didn't happen. But so, and then on top of it, we now have this explosion of information with the internet.
Right.
And my last few years, I taught a lot of what we call Comp 11, which was research writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to teach with the help of my wife, who's a media specialist. She helped a lot in the area of trying to teach the kids reliable sources.
Right.
Where do you find reliable sources? Who do you trust? How do you go about things? And, you know, at the time, the Wikipedia was just being born.
Right.
Everybody thought Wikipedia was great. And I would yell and rant and rave and carry on and show them how, you know, Wikipedia was unreliable, you know, and that kind of stuff. And yet they would, you know, try and use it. And in research papers, I would not count it as a source.
Right.
You know, because of the fact that it was unreliable. We even had a thing where there was a Ku Klux Klan group that had a webpage about Dr. Martin Luther King. And you put it up on the board, and there was a whole series of videos. This was done by a college, and we linked into that, and they would show you how they would put Dr. King's picture up there and some things about him. And then as you proceeded to go into it and read more and more, they were vilifying him.
Right.
And the movement and all this kind of stuff. At first, you know, page or so of the web page, the kids said, oh, okay, this is cool. Yeah, this is Dr. King. Yeah, man, and then we finally get to the end, and you see some of the things and the connections and the links and so on and so forth. And you say, you know, look up, you know, get on your computer here, look up who this organization is that put this page out here. And it was a branch of, you know, white supremacist group.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, really? They would do that? Yes! You know, start screaming and kicking things. And I said, wake up. What is the matter? What are you doing?
Yeah.
And so today, you know, we are in a mess because people don't check their sources.
Yeah. Well, and you know, what's funny is you hear them say that too, you know, find better sources. But the people I hear saying it, like, don't know what they mean. They don't know what they're talking about. You know, I mean, they're because, and there are so many, outlets for information that, are under the guise of being reliable sources.
Yes.
YouTube and channels and, you know, just everything. And, and a lot of right wing, you know, activists that position themselves as journalists. But, and for me, all I have to do is read a paragraph of what's written to know, really. You can tell by the writing style if this is legitimate or not, if it's a real journalist who wrote this for me.
Right. I mean, it is a time where we've never had so much information and we've never had so much misinformation. And the scariest part to me is that you don't have an idea on politicians, religious groups, whoever you want to pick. There are facets of those people that you can't rely on.
Right.
And are just obviously showing you, you know, things that you don't believe. And therefore, I believe that a vast majority of our people have just stopped. They just don't care. They say they've given up. And it absolutely freaks me out because I'm still reading 2 newspapers a day. I still, you know, active looking through news things, watching. I don't watch a lot of news on TV because I don't trust a lot of it. But I try to watch a variety of shows to see what the different people are saying and try and pick up some things. But, you know, who's going to listen to me? You know,
right.
My wife and I, yell about stuff on all the time, but we're yelling at the TV, you know.
Well, another part of all this that drives me crazy is, you know, well, so many people don't read newspapers and, you know, I get the Sunday New York Times most Sundays, but that's really about it. You know, I have a few websites on my phone, like that I can look, if I hear about a story, I can go to the Times or the Washington Post, but I'm not consistent about it. And so what we call news, generally speaking, people, when they hear that, they think cable news.
Right.
And, you know, the deregulation that took place in the 80s and 90s, you know, when I was taking your journalism class, there was a fairness doctrine.
Right.
Where both sides had to be represented. And, or, you know, fairly presented. There was, you know, no matter, I think most journalists historically have like a little bit of activist in them. So they care. They care. Yes. And that's why they do it, because they believe people need to know the truth. And so I think they're inherently, they probably lean a little left. But that has been overstated and overblown so much, which I think it started with Nixon, if not sooner. And it's just gotten magnified ever since. And then it's deregulated. And then we have Fox News, who, you know, come right out and say fair and balanced. And I remember seeing that and thinking, it can't possibly be fair and balanced if they have to say fair and balanced.
Right.
But what has happened is, it's all editorialism. It's all editorialism. It's not news. It's commentary.
Drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Well, when the host of a comedy show is the most respected journalist in your country.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, what happened while I was still teaching. You know, I'm thinking of Walter Cronkite, Huntley Brinkley, you know, people like that who I grew up with. My parents watched every night on the news and things like that. And then we got John, what's his last name?
Stewart. You think it's John Stewart? Yeah.
John Stewart is named the most trusted journalist in the world, in the United States, I mean. And I'm thinking, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Is that where we've come? And it just, again, scares me. I, you know, you talk about Fox, and the last few years I taught journalism, you know, I tried to make the kids understand how Ted Turner and Rupert Murdoch had totally changed the ball game by going 24-hour news and how they had thrown the ethics out and how their competition over, you know, viewers and advertising dollars had totally changed what news was all about, and how they had to beware of what was going on and who these people were and what their motives were.
Right.
In our journalism textbooks, we had like 2 pages on the ethical code for journalists. I would tell the kids, turn to the page, and they'd turn to them and I said, see these 2 pages? And, on the board, I had written ethics. And I said, you know what ethics means, Jess? And we got the definition of ethics out of the way. And I said, forget it. I just would take the eraser and absolutely erase it off the board. And I would say, journalists today, well, what you're experiencing, they don't know what that means. And, I just wanted to try and impress upon them that it was up to them to do some of the work so they knew what information they were getting. But as I see things, Tom, people just aren't willing to.
Yeah.
And you know, when you talk about the Facebook and the Twitter things and the posts we get and things people say, and now, you know, I don't understand, you know, all these things with the Russians and, you know, Koreans and whoever else is posting things on Facebook, you know, to influence the elections and such. You know, it's a world that I never was aware of and a hard time wrapping my brain around.
Well, you know, just I don't think most people realize this, but you know, there has been research done. Like, for instance, we think about 60 million whatever followers Donald Trump supposedly has on Twitter, and how much his sphere of influence from that. I can't remember who studied it, but you know, we know that over half of those accounts are fake.
That's what I'm getting. I saw an article recently that talked about how many bots they were,
right,
and how they were trying to take those off of Twitter and Facebook and such.
Yeah.
And again, so, you know, that's a technology thing that just, you know, I'm just not understanding of why, you know, and how, and so it is scary to me.
Yeah. It's, well, I mean, essentially scary. It's a fake account that's posing as someone taking a position, you know, in a certain way. And that's, you know, that's what they did. You know, they started all these fake accounts that looked like Americans and convinced a bunch of people not to vote. And that's what happened. And that's one of the things, the internet in general is just, it's the Wild West.
Right.
You know, it has been all along. And, you know, that job I interviewed for, I mean, at that time, this agency, it was a world renowned treatment facility, and they had a website, but they had no guidelines for it like they did for everything else. And I was buying advertising and writing radio copy and stuff, you know, and people would be coming to me trying to sell me ads online. You know, well, suddenly, you know, where I'm working in the Southeast region and placing ads in Alabama, Mississippi, the Carolinas, Georgia, Florida, this is international.
Okay.
So it was a complete game changer. And that was just the beginning of it. And then people started buying up the domain names and selling them.
Right.
I mean, I get an email once a week from somebody trying to sell me TomGentry.com. And, you know, the last couple times I've responded, you know, maybe you should check with all the other Tom Gentries out there and see what the demand is like, and then come back to me and see how much you'd like to profit from my name. It, you know, that kind right. of stuff gets to me. But the cable news thing, back to that, because I'm interested in your opinion. I think some of, so it's become complete editorialism, you know, a snippet of news that they right. essentially repeat all day long,
right?
And speculation about it with a group of people all giving their opinions. The better networks, like I think CNN is probably the most balanced. They do try to represent both sides and also don't intentionally lie.
Right. Usually, yeah.
Usually, but it's still not news. And the no. real, to me, there are so many facets of it that make, one, the editorial choices as to what's going to be covered and what's not. They don't cover anything. Right. I mean, we have troops all over the world and we don't hear anything about it.
Exactly. And do you remember when ESPN first came on there?
Mm-hmm.
And you remember how they used to run Sports Center about four times in the morning,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes you'd watch it more than once.
Yeah,
you know, it was the same taped show and all that. Well, my feeling is that CNN, you know, when they first started, had this grand idea, and it was 24-hour news, and we have world reporters and so on and so forth, and we're going to start with, you know, having this and that, and we're going to have this show over here and that show over there, and then they just realized that they couldn't afford it.
Right.
And then they drew back a little bit more, and then Ted Turner sold out and got involved with, you know, different sources, different people, American Online and all mm-hmm. this. And the information superhighway was going to be wonderful, and CNN was going to be part of it, and so on and so forth. And they just lost control of what Ted Turner's vision was at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And now, like you said, you know, because they don't have the money or don't want to spend the money,
mm-hmm.
we bring in three college professors from or former politicians or whatever that will be glad to put their face on TV, and we don't have to pay them much, if anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we send them a CNN mug or something, and you know, they'll pontificate for 10 or 15 minutes about some topic, and then we'll move on and come up with another group of people.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas actual people on the street interviewing and reporting news and doing investigative reporting,
mm-hmm.
you know, it just doesn't happen.
So then like this is, so the, that context. And one of the things, I don't know if you remember this, but you probably don't, you had a lot of students, but I graduated in 91. So
right.
I was on the staff when the first Gulf War took place, and I remember right. writing a story about CNN's coverage because I very clearly remember watching that war yes. live on TV. And that was the first time anything like that really happened.
Yes.
And a few things came from that. They learned it was too expensive. They right. stopped doing it. And then, and also, I think the Defense Department learned that they needed to do a better job of managing access. And so yes. that changed too. And that's part of the reason we don't see news about the wars we're involved in around the world.
Right.
But then now, so you fast forward all these years and there's all this conjecture going on every single night, and I have an opinion about who has kind of adapted well to that. And I'm interested in what you think. And one of the things that I believe has happened in this world of fake news or quote unquote fake news
right.
is that the real journalists that are there really doing the work are vilified.
Well, Did you watch any of the President Trump with Chris Wallace this weekend?
Oh, I've seen clips from it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
you know, he's Mike Wallace's son. And Mike Wallace was one of the great journalists of his time. And Chris is trying to be honest. And he works for Fox, and he's trying to do an honest job. And the president sits there and looks at him and says, well, I don't really like you very much. And, you know, and he tries to defend himself. Well, I tried to do both sides and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and when the president of the United States, you know, puts down these journalists and such, you know, that's hard to overcome.
Yeah. It's real power.
Yes. And, you know, we've never had, you know, even back to Nixon, you know, I was a big Watergate guy, you know, watched, read, you know, couldn't, you know, get enough of it, you know, amazed by all that was going on and all that kind of stuff. And to think of all that. And of course, Nixon was carrying on cussing and all this stuff about the journalists and so on and so forth and all, but Woodward and Bernstein, you know, but the idea is that the general public believed Woodward and Bernstein over Nixon.
Right.
You know, today, even when Mike Wallace puts up the clips or brings out the charts and all this kind of thing like he did the other day, you know, President Trump, he's right on. And I just at a loss to figure out, you know, where it all turned.
Well, you know what, I do think happened? That there are fewer people who buy into him than, you know, because of the way it's covered, it almost is presented like it's a 50-50, you know, bisection of the society. And I don't think it is at all.
No.
I mean, I think it's more like maybe 30% of the country, if that. Really actually supports him. And I personally believe that they don't even really support him. They're just hanging on to something that they can't let go of.
Living in Indiana, you realize that the Republican Party is more important than President Trump.
Right.
And that the issues that the Republican Party supposedly stands for in Indiana, it comes first.
Right.
And so it'll be interesting to see this next election, you know, when he's strayed away from so many of those principles, that how many of the Republicans in Indiana will, you know, either not participate in the election or will actually, you know, vote against somebody that's left their home principles.
Yeah.
So I'll be interested to see how that works. But
well, I also don't think it helped having Hillary Clinton running against him because she's, I mean, middle America, she's such a polarizing figure. I mean, people don't like her. They never have.
Right. I didn't understand her as a candidate at the time. I was not sold on her per se. I wonder, you know, I heard somebody say recently that you know, there's just a large part of America, male and female, that are afraid of a female president.
I'm sure there's truth in
and,
that.
You know, I just wonder, no matter how much there's certain percentages of our society wants to say, no, that gender, you know, isn't, you know, the factor.
Well, I mean, I've done episodes on male privilege, you know, and I mean, this lady who interviewed me that way and had me write that press release, I mean, she was a strong leader and she was a great department head. I learned so much from her. And because she was a strong woman, I mean, you know, most of the guys who worked there, In corporate America, I think still in general to a large degree, if you're a strong woman, you're just automatically a bitch.
Yeah.
Then, you know, and it's something deep and deeply embedded in our culture that they detest that. It's a reaction that guys have. And I was fortunate enough to have five older sisters.
Okay.
Who all had voices. You know, right. None of them shrink to anything. And so I just didn't get it. Like,
right.
And, you know, then you go to different parts of the country and they're still calling women honey and sweetheart and stuff right. like that, you know?
Right.
But so I think, you know, you hear when I say they vilify the real journalists, I mean, like Rachel Maddow. Do you ever right. watch that?
I watched a little bit, but she's late at night, and so I'm usually not watching news programs at night. I've seen some clips. I saw the part where she interviewed
Mary Trump.
President's niece.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I saw some of that, but no, I'm not a regular follower.
Well, I don't watch her all the time either, but what she does do is she works a story all the way through. Uh-huh. She's taken that format and done something substantive with it, where usually every episode there's a story. She might touch on a few different things at the beginning, but there's a theme and, you know, a story that she's following all the way through and bringing people in to comment on it. And a lot of times she's bringing in reporters who were breaking stories, like reporters from the Times. And she brought in the reporter from the Miami Herald who really started breaking this Epstein story about how he got let off down here. And so that kind of stuff. But always the first thing she says, because she'll do an opening about the news story that this person wrote or whatever and presents the facts. And the first thing she'll say to the guest is, did everything I say ring true to you? Was there anything I mischaracterized? You know, verifying.
Uh-huh.
But also she's got a staff that's doing research and digging and, you know, it's, I feel like she's done as good a job adapting in this atmosphere as anyone. Like I feel like I'm watching a real journalist when I,
well, now you've got me curious. I'm going to have to find her.
Yeah.
See, that's my complaint is that she should be on at 6 o'clock.
Right. Right.
You know, when people are sitting down at the table and want to get, you know, some valid news, instead of seeing some of these silly stories we see, you know, on some of these other things. I know that the network news is criticized for having too much negativity.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, gosh, I watch the news almost every night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Indianapolis news, then I watch national news. And sometimes, you know, you're seeing the same story, you know, three or four times with the same video and mm-hmm. everything. And you think, you know, is that lazy? Is it you're that poor? You know, you can't make enough money. What mm-hmm. what is the reason for doing this? That wasn't the way it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they're doing us a service. And because I think people are, again, turning it off, and they have so many options
yeah.
of what to watch other than the news that, you know, we're just missing the boat on so much of this stuff.
I do think local news, at least in this market here in South Florida, it really struck me one of the last big hurricanes that we missed by a hair here in West Palm Beach. You know, I was hunkered down. You know, I mean, it's a crazy time. You're worried and trying to keep track of what's going on, and I have the Weather Channel on and going back and forth between there and CNN, and I'm scared to death.
Yeah.
But then I turn on the local NBC affiliate and they're actually reporting substantive information. They're not just talking about how bad it might get. You know, they're talking about where it is, you know, details.
Right.
And I think in general, local news is still, you know, it's I guess it's, you know, some saving grace of where we're at now, like they're at least still reporting some news. But, you know, like here, and I live close to this NBC affiliate. Well, here, like NBC and Fox share staff and like the,
yes,
there's a lot of that stuff. I mean,
we have that in Indianapolis as well, you know, which amazed me.
Yeah.
You know, that they had gone that route. And again, you know, money, money, money.
Yeah.
So, I keep saying this over and over again, I'm afraid, but you know, we're doing a disservice to the people to keep them, you know, uninformed, because democracy doesn't work with an uninformed public.
Right.
We need to have good information so we can make good decisions. This mask thing is driving me up the wall. We've been wearing masks since the beginning because of my heart condition. And now finally today in Indiana, the governor said, all right, starting Monday, we're going to go back to half. Everybody's going to have to wear a mask. Mm-hmm. Well, my wife went to Kroger's today, which has signs, you must wear a mask. And some guy come running in, pushed by her that, you know, wasn't wearing a mask. And, you know, ran around, did his thing in Kroger's. And I don't know, you know, what they did, you know, when he went to check out, but I don't get why people aren't getting the information. I see on the news where they show, you know, the results of wearing a mask and not wearing a mask and the cultures that can be grown in a petri dish because you sneeze when you don't have a mask on versus when you have the mask on. That's science.
Yeah.
Why, you know, why are we, you know, fighting science so much? I don't get it.
Well, and you know, what's come of all this, I think what is really discouraging is that news doesn't matter.
Yes.
Like that science, we know it's true. And because of the mania of, you know, don't believe this, don't believe that. I mean, it doesn't matter. And, you know, we have a president who was impeached, who the Senate knew was guilty, but refused to convict him. I mean, that's where we're at.
Yes.
And I think part of it is it's too many people are too uninformed about how the government actually works. There's that. And I think also it's just, you know, we've been hearing a lot about privilege.
Yes.
I think there's that too, because, you know, I mean, so many people you'll hear, I just don't really care about politics, or I don't care, I don't want to hear about Trump. Or we have had as a society the privilege to be uninformed if we so choose and not have to worry about it. But it won't last forever. That's the thing. It's not going to last forever. And what scares me is that, you know, if you look at the trajectory of this story, you know, I mean, the whole thing, you know, we get to a place where there's the deregulation and then, you know, the parties are doing what they're doing. Then we get the most, you know, abhorrent person ever to be president who lies about absolutely everything. And we know it. And then, you know, people don't believe the media, like where this is going. I mean, it doesn't really make sense that it all got better one day.
Right. My only saving grace is that it seemed to have gotten, you know, the wrong side so quickly that maybe we can correct back to the right side as soon. I'm skeptical, but I'm hopeful. Because if we don't, you know, we're going to self-destruct.
Right.
And, you know, people have always said, you know, you study the Roman Empire and such, you know, it falls from within. And I'm not one that thinks that we're ready to do that. But if you had asked me 4 years ago that we would be where we're at today, I would have told you, what are you smoking?
Right. It is really unbelievable. It is.
I would have never believed that we would have seen this in my lifetime. I couldn't believe it. It's particularly where we were, you know, with Barack Obama's administration for eight years. You know, you can complain about this, that, and the other thing. But I think most of us felt pretty good about where we were at financially, morally, positioned in the world, you know, so on and so forth. I think we thought we were on a pretty good trajectory. Not so much now.
No, it's awful scary. It is.
When Mexico and Canada
don't come in,
ask us to stay home.
Yeah.
We don't really want you to come visit. We don't want your money. You know, you guys just stay where you're at. Then we're in a time that I never thought I'd live to see.
Yeah. Well, the pandemic is, it's just a whole other thing that is even more bizarre than everything else. And, you know, then we have the race stuff that's coming up, which I think is affected by the fact that people have been stuck at home and not able to work. And, you know, everybody was available to watch that George Floyd video. You know, there was a captive audience when that came out. So, yeah, I mean, it's just.
Well, it was so shocking, Tom. I mean, you know, everybody's got a phone now with a camera on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've heard of shootings before. We've heard of lynchings before. But you didn't see in live action, you know, somebody with total disregard with his hands crossed or his hands in his pocket. Taking the life of another human being over $10, $20, whatever.
Yeah, 20.
And then shortly after, you know, the guy falls asleep as a DUI in the parking lot, and we shoot him in the back as he runs away, and you got pictures of that, you know, again. Yeah. So you start questioning, okay, what is it? I have three nephews that are police officers, and I love them, and I think they're great people. But when you see with your own eyes these things that these cameras have brought to us today, you can't deny, you know, that it's going to change you, and change your outlook on things. And if it doesn't change your outlook on things, then you got to question your values, I think.
Yeah. Well, and you think about that, you know, the complete indifference that like Chauvin had, you know, when he's got bystanders recording him with a phone, pleading with him to get off the guy, he's going to die.
Yes.
And you see his eyes. I mean, it's clear he doesn't care.
Yes.
And then, so you see that, and then you compare that to the video of the protesters at the state house in Michigan with assault rifles in the faces of cops with no, you know, and they didn't do anything to them. Nothing.
Right.
And so how can we pretend that it doesn't make a difference whether you're white or black when somebody who didn't do anything gets shot and somebody who's being a horse's ass, nothing happens, you know? Right. It's crazy. It really is. But here's where I find hope with all this is, you know, especially like down here when the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting took place and those kids rose up.
Yes.
I mean, they're not having it. And, you know, I think a lot of this stuff that's happening is it's the baby boomer generation and, you know, you guys aren't going to be around forever. I mean, you know, I think younger generations, people are more accepting, you know, it's going to get better. You know, I just hope that enough of us care about the truth and care about journalism enough to inform the rest of us, you know?
Well, I can tell you the last 10 years of teaching, I would stand in the hallway by my door. You know, I had that senior hallway. I was, as it turned out, the last few years, there was most of the time I was the only teacher in the hallway. The AD people went away, and Mrs. Bingaman retired, and they ended up, you know, not replacing her after a while. I would stand here with my arms crossed watching the kids walk by and thinking, you know, I think we're going to be all right.
Yeah.
I think these kids are getting, you know, there was fewer fights. The kids got together. There wasn't the cliques like you used to see. The racial tension was gone as far as I could tell. You know, there's always a few pockets of things you don't understand or see. But as I stood there watching the kids walk by and saw how they mixed and mingled and how they did things in the foyer and such, I felt really good about where we were headed. And, you know, to see the racial tension the last two or three years that are created by some of these adults, you know, it has bothered me, because I really thought that we were past. I actually was naive enough to think that a majority of this was past it. And I'm hoping that they're going to rise up and say, hey, we're done with this. We're not having any more of this. You guys are going to have to crawl back into your cellars. And
well, I think it's beginning to happen. You know, I mean, yeah. The Washington Redskins announced that they're going to finally rename.
Yeah.
A couple days ago, which I was surprised to see finally, but it was the pressure from the advertisers.
Right.
That's really what the money.
But Nike and people like that put the pressure on them because they were knowing that the pressure was going to come from people who buy their products.
Yeah.
That they weren't going to have it anymore.
Yeah.
They were going to have to make the social stand on some of these things, or we're going to take our money elsewhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, that always becomes a very scary thing for businessmen.
Well, I do think it's beginning to happen. And one of the things that Trump has brought is he has emboldened the angry.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people who didn't like Barack Obama will tell you it isn't because he's a black man. But what else is there? I mean, he was a great president. I mean, he was brilliant. You know,
that's kind of the way I saw it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and they just didn't want it. You know, it's not how they envision this country. Yeah. And it makes them mad. And, you know, I mean, I get it. But, I mean, it's come on. You know, at some point, it's right and wrong. You know, how are you going to treat people?
Yes, exactly. Mm. Well, Tom, you living in Florida have seen countless times where the weather has turned bad and people's homes have been destroyed, and we rally around to help rescue and we, you know, rebuild and all these kinds of things, because as Americans, that's what we do.
Right.
And, you know, what I've seen the last couple of years has made me question what happened. But I'm with you. I don't think that's dead.
No.
I think it might be wounded. But I think that it's going to recover, and we're going to show that we're better than what we've acted the last few years.
I actually think we're reaching the I don't know what you'd call it, the point where of no return, where it's absolutely going to get better. But we're right there on the edge, and that's why so many people are freaking out right now about the race stuff. I think that's why this is happening, because the writing's on the wall. Our country's not going to exist anymore. And if we're going down with a, you know, bang or whatever. I mean, it's scary. It's really troubling. I have to limit what I'm watching online and stuff, because I can become very upset. And at some point I have to, like, this really doesn't matter. If, you know, I don't have to consume so much that I become upset every single day. It's okay to just live life. But so, man, this has been fantastic. I've enjoyed this.
I've enjoyed it a lot.
So now, one of the questions I always ask, I mean, I didn't ask you in the beginning, I always ask, how do you spend a day? But we've covered that. You're retired. You play golf as often as you can. You do some volunteering. You know, you're a retired teacher, but, you know, in hindsight, looking back on your life, if there was a time when you needed encouragement or, you know, words of wisdom, when would that have been? And what would you go back to say to John Snyder, the younger John Snyder?
Well, I would say to the younger John Snyder, don't sweat the small stuff. You know, that's a cliche, but, you know, used to worry about every little thing. And I had a bad habit in the class as a classroom teacher of focusing in on one troublemaker and forgetting the other 26 that were doing exactly what I wanted to say. Mm-hmm. How do I get that one to do, fall in line? And instead of focusing, you know, more energy on the 26 and hoping that the other one would catch up. So, you know, I would say that. And I would say be thankful for all the time you have with your kids. Mm-hmm. You know, because mine too are grown and gone and successful and doing, you know, their own thing with, you know, good wives and I got a couple grandkids and all that, which is all great. But boy, you know, when you're sitting around as a retiree and you see some pictures or you think about the ball games and some of those kinds of things, and I was at most things, but not all things. And you want to make sure that you're as many as humanly possible.
Yeah.
Because those days go fast and they're the special times.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I haven't talked to you about this yet, but, you know, the reason I called you initially was to ask you to read something I wrote. And right. And I sent you a couple pieces, and it was just like exactly what I was looking for. Such great feedback and very, very helpful. Good. And, you know, it's, I knew I could count on you. You know,
well,
and
thank you.
It's been a long time. I mean, it's been a long time, but that has never changed. And, you know, I mean, there are a few guys. I was talking to my mom about this the other day too. I told her that I was talking to you and you were going to be on here. And I had a little league coach and really like you and Dave Kitchell. You know, are the three guys from my childhood, adolescence, early adulthood who, you know, I don't know what I would have done without you guys, really. And like you said, just a few little words here and there of encouragement or whatever, or me just knowing I could count on you. Cause I don't know if you remember, but there are a couple times I came to you as a kid and, you know, I'm worried about my best friend and,
right.
And, you know, you helped, you were always there. Yeah. You know, when I think about, that's just really important to me. You know, it's those people to me who really just, I don't even know how I want to explain it, but, I guess part of it for me is that I've had people in the opposite role in my life who had greater influence. And man, that stuff's really hard to overcome because when you get those negative messages, eventually you don't need the other person anymore. You give them to yourself. You take on their voice and it's really hard to break. And so just, you know, I've always, just held such a close place in my heart for you and those other guys, because, you know, I needed you and you were there.
I'm glad. Glad I was there.
Yeah.
You're, you know, one of the guys I look back at, not only, you know, because of what you did when you were in school, but what you're doing now.
Yeah.
And I know there's a lot of us here in the community that are thrilled with what you're doing and the help that you are for other people. And it makes us feel real good, and we're quite proud of you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it, Snyder.
Just the product, some bad seeds.
All right, John Snyder. Could have talked to him for hours and hours, and hopefully I'll have an opportunity to do that. I'd be remiss not to mention his sidekick at Kokomo High School in Kokomo, Indiana, where he was the advisor for the Red and Blue, the school newspaper, and along with a woman named Ann Bingaman, was the advisor for the yearbook staff. It was called the Sargasso. And so I, you know, worked on the paper and contributed a little bit to the yearbook, especially my senior year. But the both of them were just so good to me, so supportive. And, man, just such a great thing to look back on. And I'm glad to have the opportunity to show them my gratitude. Although Miss Bingaman wasn't on the podcast, I've had the opportunity to go and see her and let her know how important she was to me too. So hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a review or a rating at Apple Podcasts or wherever it is you listen to podcasts. If you're not a subscriber, please become one. Every little bit helps. If you want to be a supporter of the show, you can find it on Patreon. That's patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Doing more and more for patrons there. Gain access to supplemental content, early access to episodes like this one will come out on a Tuesday, and it's going to be available on the Sunday prior. So if you're that hardcore a fan, you get early access. You can find the show on Instagram, and you can find us on Facebook, both at The Path to Authenticity. Just putting together the finishing touches on a new website, thepathtoauthenticity.com. Very excited about that. Want to kind of broaden the scope of what I do and grow the community a little bit. So there's a link in the show notes to the site, and there's also the phone number where you can call and leave a voicemail. Any feedback, we'd love it. Ideas, whatever you have. And you can email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. It's been a blast, and so grateful that he came and spent the time with me recording this episode. And thank you guys for listening. Please wear a mask. Please look out for your neighbors. And just be nice.
great, honeybee.
The Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.